I made several comments last week about the feast in Lake Geneva. A number of you weren't here. I thought I'd again share a few of those because I thought we really had an outstanding feast in Lake Geneva. And from all the reports I heard, from other feast coordinators and around the country and around the world, just very positive reports about the feast and the spirit and attitude of the feast. It was certainly that way, in Lake Geneva, as far as a positive spirit and attitude, a great deal of friendliness among brethren. With just 262 as our high attendance in Lake Geneva, it was reachable, to try to get around and meet everybody. Everybody there at the feast, if you made an effort of doing that. Some of you, because of the volunteer service you were doing, did meet everybody because they came to you, either giving out hymnals or working in information, some of those things. So a lot of that, there was just a lot of good fellowship, and I thought a real friendly, peaceful spirit throughout the feast. I was especially pleased with the example of our young people. I mentioned it last week there at the feast, who received several compliments from the staff, who specifically commented how that our teens who gathered in the lobby there at Timber Ridge and the maintenance staff, people there, the staff at Timber Ridge the first day or so, kind of watched closely, but they were so, pleased with what they saw. They said, your kids just have fun. They just talk. They visit. No problem at all. They were just very positive about our teens. And I think I mentioned the manager at Timber Ridge commented how that he has two teens. And he said, when an adult talks to them, I notice they kind of hang their head and they don't say much. So your teens are different. They look you in the eye. They shake your hand. They smile and they talk to you. And he was just very positive, about our young people. The staff said that these were the easiest people to work with, both at Timber Ridge and at the Geneva Grand Lodge itself, where we met there in the auditorium. And some of the staff said to one of the managers, we wish we could have these folks here 365 days a year. And so when he told me that, I said, well, make us an offer. We can't refuse, and we'll consider it. But it was just very positive throughout the feast. The example that the brethren set, that our teens set, I thought was outstanding. The contribution to the food pantry, I think I mentioned last week, we had the food pantry barrels in place for about 6 days. The director told me that every day they were full and that we more than doubled their stores in that period of time. I went over to meet her and to see the place. Also, we had a check because we had several hundred dollars donations to give to them. And they're just overwhelmed, by the generosity of God's people there at the feast in Lake Geneva. Maintenance crew was very positive. It was just very, very positive in so many ways throughout the feast. And as we heard in the sermon, that just leaves you on a high. You wish you could stay, but you realize that's not what it's all about. Someday that will be the case, but at this time and in this age, that is not the case. But with those things in mind, I'd like you to read something in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 13. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 13. The words of Jesus Christ, who said, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? How do you season salt? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the salt of the earth. During the 8 days of the Feast of Tabernacles, thousands of God's people, wherever they were, salted various cities around the world, salted various communities around the world. In a sense, didn't we flavor the communities where we stayed? In many ways, some restaurants there in Lake Geneva, I know at Timber Ridge, made the effort to let us know that they had prepared by having all beef patties and beef sausages and things like that for breakfast, in other areas as well, other restaurants as well. And by our example and what we did in those communities, in a sense, salted or flavored the communities where we were, hopefully with a sweet savor. And they'll let us back. I know in Lake Geneva they really want us back. And hopefully it's the same way in other communities as well. And now we're back home. But we're still supposed to be salting, aren't we? Salting the communities where we live in whatever way we can. Salting our families who may not be in God's church by our example, being a sweet savor. salting the establishments where we meet, even right here, or any place where we conduct business as a church, where you as a church member, you know, have relationships. We're still salting the world, even though we're no longer at the Feast of Tabernacles. We read here in Matthew 5 that God calls his people the salt of the earth. Why? Why did he choose that, you know, that analogy? Why in the Bible did he say, you know, you are the salt of the earth? When you think about it, salt has many uses. We find many of those examples throughout the scriptures, both literal uses and figurative. We'll look at some of those in a little bit. We know that salt is a preservative. Salt is a seasoning agent. And interestingly enough, salt was used in making covenants or in making contracts. In the United States, we flavor the communities where we met, and certainly in other places around the world. And there were some large, I don't have the numbers with me, they're on that report, but anywhere from in the U.S., from around 200, Keystone I think was just under 200, 190 something, all the way up to 1,400 in St. Augustine, 1,400 plus. And, you know, and when you bring 1,400 people into a community, or even 200, you know, 400 some of the feast sites, when you bring that many, there is some impact. There is impact economically. You know, there's some impact in those communities. We add some kind of flavor. Even the smaller groups that we are these days, it still adds some kind of flavor. And again, now here we are back home, still hoping to add flavor to the communities where we live. So again, why does God call us the salt of the earth? What does that represent for us today? You know, sometimes when you call somebody, it can be a pejorative term to call somebody a salty character or somebody who uses salty language. And yet God calls us the salt of the earth. Again, why? As we try to take what we heard at the feast and what we learned at the feast and hopefully what we absorbed, you know, at the feast, and we want to apply it to our lives now in the coming months, what do we need to keep in mind in being described as the salt of the earth? Let's go back to Genesis. I'd like you to notice some examples where salt is mentioned in the scriptures and how it's used. Genesis chapter 19. Genesis chapter 19. We'll look at a few examples. Genesis 19 verse 24. Probably the first one you may have thought of when you think of salt in the Old Testament. We won't read the whole account. You're familiar with it. Where God overthrew the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. We read in verse 24, then the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But his wife looked back, Lot's wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Perhaps the first example we thought of in the Old Testament as a pillar of salt. Lot's wife became for a period of time, a perpetual monument as a warning. She was a warning to those who would start out on the path, in this case of God's way or God's instructions, and then look back, desiring the old way, wanting to turn back. She became a monument as a warning of that frame of mind, of that attitude. Look in Luke chapter 17, what Christ said about this, and someday I'd like to just give a sermon about this subject alone, why Christ said this. Luke chapter 17. And in verse 28, he says, likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate. He's talking first about the days of Noah, then about the days of Lot. They ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. They carried on life as normal, just went about their daily life. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. In that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house, let him not come down to take them away. And likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back. And then he says, remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. It's such an interesting reminder. And like I said, I think it is worth just giving a sermon on that phrase alone. Why Christ said that? Remember Lot's wife. He certainly gave us a warning It was a warning for today, not just for those in his day, but it's a warning for us today as well. Remember Lot's wife, because she was an example of the consequences of disbelief, not believing God's warning to flee, reluctance to leave a doomed city. Well, we went to the feast, didn't we? Because God said, leave your homes, go to the Feast of Tabernacles, and we believe his warnings about a doomed society. We believe God's warnings about fleeing, you know, from this doomed society by pulling ourselves out of it, by not being like this society. We understand God's promises that as Lot and his family were in a doomed city, we are in a doomed society. And unfortunately, Lot's wife turned back and looked back, desiring that was turned into a pillar of salt. The vision of the world to come was strengthened, I think, in all of our minds by this past Feast of Tabernacles, and I hope we brought that home stronger than ever. And, you know, if you weren't able to go to the feast, or if, you'd like to hear more of the messages, as I mentioned, the Sabbath, I think there, a number of feast sites now have the messages up on the Feast of Tabernacles website, you know, to hear from other feast sites as well. But our vision was strengthened by what we heard. And that is important that takes place. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 2. So when we think of salt, we find an example where Lot's wife was turned into a pillar of salt. And that served as a warning, a memorial of warning. In Luke chapter 2 and verse 13, speaking about the offerings, we won't read the whole context, but notice this statement, "In every offering of your grain offering, you shall season with salt. You shall not allow the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt." Leviticus 2:13. You shall offer salt. And this interesting statement, "You shall not allow the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your grain offering." Again, an interesting statement. Now, with that thought in mind, let's read Numbers 18, verse 19. All of this helps us understand, will help us understand, I hope, why God refers to his people, why Christ called his people the salt of the earth. Numbers chapter 18, verse 19. Again, speaking about the offerings, "All the heave offerings of the holy things, which the children of Israel offer to the Lord, I have given to you and your sons and daughters with you as an ordinance forever. It is a covenant of salt forever before the Lord with you and your descendants with you." It is a covenant of salt. Numbers 18:19. A covenant of salt. It's, again, an interesting statement. A covenant of salt forever. I think the King James says an everlasting covenant of salt, or a covenant of salt forever. And as we read in Leviticus, the salt of the covenant of your God. Now, the Sonsino commentary, commenting on Leviticus 2:13, says this: "Salt is a preservative and typifies that which is abiding or lasting." Salt is a preservative, typifies, it's a figure of something that abides or lasts long for, in this case, forever. God's covenants, God's promises. Salt typifies their abiding nature. Commenting on also on Leviticus 2:13, Unger's Bible Dictionary says this: "Covenanting parties," those who entered into a contract or a covenant, "were accustomed to partake of salt. It's part of the contract procedure to make the covenant a covenant of salt that is inviolably sure. They would partake of salt as a symbol of making this an abiding covenant, to make it sure. The meaning appears to have been that the salt, with its power to strengthen food and keep it from decay, symbolized the unbending truthfulness of that self-surrender to the Lord when they made a covenant with God, and in their offerings to God included salt. It symbolized the unbending truthfulness of that self-surrender to the Lord embodied in the sacrifice. They were supposed to be, unbending in their self-surrender to God." That is, they would not yield. They would yield to God. They were totally humble themselves before God. We know that Israel had a challenge with that, had a problem with that, but yet the symbolism was there. It was supposed to symbolize that self-surrender to the Lord, embodied in the sacrifice, by which all impurity and hypocrisy were repelled. The salt was to repel impurity and hypocrisy. It was a symbol of that. So here we have salt being used as a symbol of an everlasting covenant of salt, everlasting covenant with God, symbolic of casting out impurity, casting out hypocrisy, something that would be abiding or lasting. And it was part of the offerings and sacrifice, the sacrifice that were made to God. In Ezra chapter 6, Ezra chapter 6, beginning in verse 1. Ezra 6, verse 1, just the setting, a little bit of the background. Then King Darius issued a decree, and a search was made in the archives where the treasures were stored in Babylon. And at Ekmetha in the palace, that in the province of Media, a scroll was found, and in it a record was written thus. In the first year of King Cyrus, King Cyrus issued a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the house be rebuilt, the place where they offered sacrifices, and let the foundation of it be firmly laid, its height 60 cubits, its width 60 cubits, and it goes on to describe some of those things. But then notice, beginning in verse 8. Now therefore, Tattenai, governor of the region, verse 8, moreover I issue a decree as to what you shall do for the elders of these Jews for the building of this house of God. Let the cost be paid at the king's expense from taxes on the region beyond the river. Not really the king's expense, but, you know, taxes. So that's the way government works. That is to be given immediately to these men so that they are not hindered in whatever they need. And notice what were some of the things included and what they might need for sacrifices, for this rebuilding. Young bulls, rams, lambs for the burnt offerings of the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine and oil. According to the request of the priests who are in Jerusalem, let it be given them day by day without fail. Salt is mentioned as being needed. It had to be put with the offerings to make them acceptable to God. In God's eyes, salt gave those offerings, because of what it symbolized, a savor that God desired. It was important. It was to symbolize the abiding nature, the casting out of impurity, the self-surrender of the people and the minds and attitude of the people. So salt was important. And it gave the sacrifices a sweet savor that God desired. During the Feast of Tabernacles, for 8 days, we were a community of brethren spending time together every day in fellowship, in working together, in being instructed together. Spent a lot of time together if you add up all the hours, you know, that we were with brethren. All of that, you know, builds a closeness through God's Spirit. God's Spirit works in that. And there certainly was a closeness, and you felt the closeness, experienced that closeness with brethren, spending that time together in God's Spirit at work. We also, again, as I said, salted those communities. The Feast of Tabernacles for God's people was the most important thing going on earth, and most people didn't even know about it. You know, in those communities, it was the most important thing going on in their community. Most people didn't know about it, didn't really understand what was going on. Let's look at something in John 15. John chapter 15. What does this have to do with salt in light of some of those things we've already looked at? John 15 and verse 14. Verses we read during Passover season. You are my friends, Christ said, if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all things that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should remain, that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give you. Now there's some echo of here of some of the things we just read, as far as, you know, God has appointed us, God has called us, We are to bear fruit. That fruit should remain. It's to abide. It's to last. These things I command you, that you love one another. Again, an interesting series of statements. What does that have to do with salt? Especially that statement that you love one another. Let's go back to Mark chapter 9. Matthew, Mark, and Luke each mention this matter of God's people being compared to salt. And in Mark chapter 9, in verse 49 and 50, we find these statements. Mark 9, 49. For everyone will be seasoned with fire, and every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt. Salt is good, but if the salt loses its flavor, how will you season it? Have salt in yourselves and have peace with one another. Again, an interesting statement. Have salt in yourselves and have peace with one another. And God's people seasoned with fire. Let's go back to verse 43 and pick up the context of some of this. Verse 43, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life maimed rather than having two hands to go to hell, into the fire that shall never be quenched, where their worm dies not and the fire is not quenched. And if your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life lame, rather than having two feet to be cast into hell, into the fire that shall never be quenched. The word for hell there, Gehenna, where their worm dies not and the fire is not quenched. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye, rather than having two eyes to be cast into hell fire, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. Of course, the lesson is, you know, plucking out an eye or cutting off a hand or a foot doesn't change how we think. You know, the lesson is change how we think. Be different, you know, in character. Verse 49 then, for everyone will be seasoned with fire. Trials that test us. Trials that test our relationships. Trials that test our love for God. Trials that test our love for one another. And then it says, if we are seasoned with salt, we will have peace with one another. And if we're seasoned with salt, we'll have peace with God. We must have peace in order to love one another. And that's what, you know, John was saying back there in John 15, where we read about having love for one another. There has to be peace to love one another. We have to be seasoned with salt to have peace, you know, and yet we know that there are trying times ahead that will test the people of God. So again, it's an interesting mention of salt in the life of a Christian and how it applies. Let's go to John chapter 17. I'll go a little further with this. John 17. Christ came to the earth for a number of reasons. And certainly he came to the earth to work with human beings, to work with people, to fulfill God's will. Why? John 17, verse 5. And now, O Father, glorify me together with yourself with the glory which I had with you before the world was. I have manifested your name to the men whom you have given me out of the world. They were yours, you gave them to me, and they have kept your word. Now they have known that all things which you have given me are from you. For I have given to them the words which you have given me, and they have received them, and have known surely that I came forth from you, and they have believed that you sent me. I pray for them, I do not pray for the world, but for those whom you have given me, for they are yours. And all mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I am glorified in them. Christ came to this earth to work with people, to reveal the Father, to fulfill God's will, so that we human beings could gain our purpose for existence. If Christ hadn't come to the earth, we couldn't gain our purpose for existence. Because he did, we can. And he says, if we follow his example, then we can gain that purpose. We can have peace in our lives. Our relationships with God, with Jesus Christ, with one another can be right. Christ came to help bring all of that about so that we could accomplish those things. So again, what does it mean to be the salt of the earth for us today? Salt was an important part of sacrifices. Do we realize that sacrifices are still going on? Sacrifices are still going on. Now, not as some thought many years ago when we began keeping the Feast of Tabernacles in Big Sandy, as Mr. Earl mentioned. 10,000 people back in the woods, you know, out in the countryside of East Texas, and there were suspicions that there were, you know, thousands of, you know, reports, false reports of hundreds of animals that were being sacrificed back in those pine woods. And that, you know, rams and bulls and sheep, you know, were being slaughtered, you know, by those Church of Godders back there in the pine woods, you know, all during the Feast of Tabernacles. And that's what was going on because people read, you know, in the scriptures what the Old Testament description of the Feast of Tabernacles was all about. So that's what they're doing. Of course, that's not true. I didn't see anybody in Lake Geneva sacrifice a lamb, a bull, or a cow, or anything. Well, I guess we had some good steaks and some good food, you know, that way, but you know, nobody out slaughtering animals other than those that have already been slaughtered. My daughter and her boyfriend did a couple of meals for us, and one day did some excellent ribeye steaks. They bought a little grill and took it out in the parking lot, but it was pouring. It was just pouring rains. But they did the grilling outside under an umbrella, under my umbrella. And that umbrella was delightful for the next few days because it smelled like steak. Every time I opened it up, I could smell this steak, and it was just great. Anyway, do we realize that sacrifices are still going on? Romans chapter 12, verse 1. You're familiar with the scripture here. Romans 12, verse 1. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, Paul said, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies, our lives, a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable or spiritual or rational service. The service to God that makes sense to the converted mind. Presenting our lives and our bodies, a living sacrifice to God. We are an offering. A sacrifice presented to God, acceptable. Salted by what? Salted by our high priest, who did the salting back then. But today we are salted by our high priest, Jesus Christ. We are salted by Jesus Christ. The salt in the Old Testament sacrifices also pictured what Christ was going to do. The sacrifices were a reminder of God's willingness to forgive, but they were also a shadow of things to come. Those Old Testament sacrifices were a picture of Christ's future sacrifice and what that would accomplish. And that Christ's sacrifice would accomplish purifying, preserving us spiritually, those who were called, just as the salt did to those sacrifices. But in this case, it's through his death and through Christ living in us, we are salted and become a sacrifice that has a sweet savor to God. And so when Christ calls us the salt of the earth, it has much more to do than just the, you know, the figures of speech as a preservative, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is part of it, but it's the spiritual message of we are salted through our high priest, his death, his life, make us, that as it lives in us, makes us a sweet savor in God's eyes. Purified salt was also a picture of Christ's character. That salt was to be pure, and it was also a picture of Christ's own character. Notice verse 2, and do not be conformed. This is how we sacrifice today. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. This is how we sacrifice today. The body, the church of God, is seasoned and salted, and God loves its savor. It was a little easier during the feast, wasn't it? It was for me, you know, to remember these things and to be salted by, you know, the character of God, the character of Jesus Christ. A little easier during the feast because we have hundreds around us helping. We're in services every day with our noses in the Bible. You know, we are talking about those things, and God's Spirit is there because His people are gathered together. And in a sense, it was easier during the feast than it is when we come back home, and now we're on our own, other than, you know, helping one another as we try to do here. But it was easier during the feast. When we went to the feast, we hopefully left trials behind us. We knew they would be there when we got back. We try to leave them behind us, and we trusted God for help, for protection, and for His inspiration. We came back home, and as we heard in the sermonette, we stepped back into a world that is not yet the world tomorrow. I came back home, looked around, and said, this is not yet the world tomorrow. You probably did the same thing. And at times, we are seasoned with fire. That is, trials. When that happens, and we're back home from the feast, and we go through those trials, it is important to remember what Christ said here in Matthew 11. We are being seasoned by those trials, and as we have the salt of Christ living in us, we can endure those things. But it is important to remember what He said here in Matthew 11. Matthew 11, verse 28. Come to Me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take My yoke upon you and learn from Me. For I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For My yoke is easy and My burden is light. It's a promise from Jesus Christ. We are yoked to Him. He helps us through the hills, trials, the mountains, all of those things. I'd like to read something to you. Some of you may have heard this in the past. Came across it several years back. It's called The Road of Life. Anybody ever heard this little thing? It's by, it says, author unknown. It's titled The Road of Life. I think you'll enjoy it. Listen to this. At first, I saw God as my observer, my judge, keeping track of the things I did wrong. He was out there sort of like a president. I recognized His picture when I saw it, but I really didn't know Him. But later on, when I met Christ, it seemed as though life were rather like a bike ride, but it was a tandem bike. And I noticed that Christ was in the back helping me pedal. I don't know just when it was that He suggested we change places, but life has not been the same since. When I had control, I knew the way. It was rather boring, but predictable. It was the shortest distance between two points, the easy path. But when He took the lead, He knew delightful long cuts. Up mountains, through rocky places, at breakneck speeds. It was all I could do to hang on. Even though it looked like madness, He said, pedal. I worried and was anxious, and I asked, where are you taking me? He laughed and didn't answer, and I started to learn to trust. I forgot my boring life and entered into the adventure. And when I'd say, I'm scared, He'd lean back and touch my hand. He took me to people with gifts that I needed, gifts of healing, acceptance, and joy. They gave me their gifts to take on my journey, my Lord's and mine. And we were off again. He said, give the gifts away. They're extra baggage, too much weight. So I did, to the people we met. And I found that in giving, I received, and still our burden was light. I did not trust Him at first in control of my life. Does that sound familiar to any of us? I thought He'd wreck it, but He knows bike secrets, knows how to make it bend to take sharp corners, jump to clear high rocks, fly to shorten scary passages. And I am learning to shut up and pedal in the strangest places. And I'm beginning to enjoy the cool breeze on my face with my delightful constant companion, Christ. And when I'm sure I just can't do any more, He just smiles and says, pedal. It's called The Road of Life, author unknown. And it really does, I think, express well the sentiments here in Matthew 11, verse 28, 29, and 30, about how that His yoke is easy and His burden is light. Because back in the real world at this time, not yet in the world tomorrow in the time of the millennium, we are seasoned with trials. And we do have challenges that we face. Just a couple of other statements in the New Testament speak about salt. Good reminders for us. Colossians 4, verse 6. Colossians chapter 4 and verse 6. This one is, again, a well-known statement. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt. Well, this is not the way, we talk about having salty language. That's not what it's referring to. Using just the wrong kind of language, but seasoned with salt that you may know how you ought to answer each one. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt. That is, with the mind of Christ who's living in us. And then Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 29. Ephesians 4, 29 completes the thought, I think, when it says, "Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification," or building up, the word means, for necessary building up, "that it may impart grace to the hearers." It's what my mother would have said, think before you speak. You know, that we all learned growing up. You know, we're supposed to think before we speak. It talks about edification, building up. And so we're reminded to ask ourselves about how we talk. Is what we say, does it build up and edify? Salt here is used to symbolize speech that is not, it symbolizes speech that is seasoned with wise, interesting, worthwhile things to say that come from the mind of Christ, that come from, you know, a mind that is in harmony with Jesus Christ. The kind of thing we talked about during the feast, you know, the kind of things that we are happy to come to Sabbath services to not be around, you know, people at school, people at work who have all kinds of other things to talk about. And the language is certainly not seasoned with salt. We're reminded that we are to have language seasoned with salt to impart grace, that is, to be considered a blessing. Things that we have to say are worthwhile. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 10. Salt reminds us that we are to allow the converted mind, the mind of Jesus Christ, to be the motivating factor in our makeup, in how we are, what we do, what we say. That the motivating factor is that converted mind. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1. "Now I, Paul, myself, am pleading with you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, who in presence am lowly among you, but being absent am bold towards you." So Paul is writing about, he's going to talk about the example of Jesus Christ. "But I beg you that when I am present, I may not be bold with that confidence by which I intend to be bold against some, and who think of us as if we walked according to the flesh. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled." Paul is talking about living by God's standards, employing the spiritual weapons of warfare that we've been given, ready to put away disobedience and continue to grow in obedience, bringing thoughts into captivity. What we say, what we do, what we think, bringing all of that into captivity, learning to live by God's standards in this life and leading our lives by those things, leading others by our example in those things. I think it was one of the most striking messages in all the sermons at the Feast in Lake Geneva. And that is this matter of learning to live by God's standards today as part of our preparation for the world tomorrow and leading in the world tomorrow. Learning to live and growing in those standards. Christ set the perfect example of one who was seasoned, one who was seasoned and who sacrificed his life for us. If he had given in to Satan, you know, even once, if he had taken the easy way out of the trials that he faced, we could not obtain what God offers: forgiveness, salvation, growth in the mind of Jesus Christ. As one of the most essential articles of food, salt also symbolized hospitality that cemented friendships. Symbolized hospitality that cemented friendships. There is an Arab expression that goes, "There is salt between us." And in most ancient cultures, salt was to eat salt together was a sign of friendship. "There is salt between us." Another Arab expression says, "Eat the salt of the palace." What did that mean? To eat the salt of the king was symbolic of owing him utmost fidelity, loyal to the king. Certainly that's what Jesus Christ expects of us. Fidelity to him. We have entered into an unbreakable league, that is, an unbreakable covenant. We have entered into an unbreakable contract with God and with Jesus Christ, and we owe utmost fidelity. He's done the same thing with us. Didn't Christ say he will never leave us or forsake us? So he's done the same thing that we have done. And all symbolized, you know, symbolized by this salt. So salt, when you think about what it is, it's a flavoring agent. It's a sign of friendship. It made sacrifices acceptable to God. It was a symbol of purity and a preserving agent. God calls his people the salt of the earth. We demonstrate that, or we are to demonstrate that we are, by our thoughts, by our attitudes, by our conduct, which are to be the conduct and the attitudes and thoughts and actions of Jesus Christ. We demonstrate that we've entered into that covenant of salt. Colossians 1, verse 27. Colossians chapter 1, verse 27. You know, it has a great deal of meaning for Christ to say that his people are the salt of the earth, for God to consider his people the salt of the earth. And, of course, in our culture, even today, it can be a positive expression. You know, they're just, you know, they're the salt of the earth. Someone is the salt of the earth, meaning they're a good person, something that is desirable. Colossians 1, verse 27. To them, it says, God willed to make known what are the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles, this mystery, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. This mystery, Christ in us, the hope of glory. Christ in us, living, growing, like salt, making us acceptable to God the Father. We become more acceptable and more savory to God the Father as Christ grows in us. We then go out into our daily lives doing what we do day in, day out, and God expects us to share our character, to share our being salted with Christ living in us, to share that with others. It was easier at the feast. But here we are back in the world, and it's not the world tomorrow yet. I remember a few years ago when we were in New Zealand for the feast, 2008. Here we were at the feast. Beautiful Lake Taupo, the feast site on Lake Taupo. We were staying in a condominium right on the lake. And there was a nice walking path around this huge lake. Of course, it was a very large lake, so we just walk a stretch and walk back. And one morning, I think my wife was with me, we were walking. You know, here it was a beautiful day. It was during the feast. We're on the lake shore, beautiful scenery. And out on the green grass behind this one complex of buildings were a bunch of ducks, nice, friendly ducks. And there was a whole, I guess, flock of ducks, herd of ducks, whatever. There's a bunch of ducks in this yard. And, you know, probably 15, 20 of them. And they were all the same brand of duck, except for one. One duck had kind of slipped in among the crowd, and the other ducks really didn't like it. And they began knocking him over, pecking at him, just drove him, you know, away and wouldn't stop. As the ducks started trying to run away, some of those ducks went after him, you know, and kept chasing him and poking at him and knocking him over, and they were just merciless to him. And I thought, how interesting. Here are the Feast of Tabernacles, the wonderful world tomorrow. Even the nature of animals have changed, but we're not there yet. I had never seen such a mean bunch of ducks, you know. I mean, you think of lions and tigers, but you know, here are ducks just as ornery and ugly as could be. And it was just interesting to me that this was happening during the Feast of Tabernacles. And you know, not God's kingdom yet. Likewise for us. We're hopefully a little more prepared with what we receive during the feast. And Christ is growing in us and we've been salted a little bit more. But we are in the world, and we have trials to face. Let's turn to Matthew 5. I want to look. We'll conclude by looking at these three places again in Matthew, Mark, Luke, where salt is mentioned. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all recorded sayings in which Jesus Christ compared his disciples to salt, and he refers to the uselessness of salt if it loses its saltiness. Notice what he said in Matthew 5:13. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing, but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Christ's disciples are to be a preservative, a blessing to the world. We believe we are preserving the truth of God in a world that doesn't understand it. And in this whole context of being a light to the world, the verses go on. It talks about being the salt of the earth that is not to lose its savor, that is to remain pleasing in God's eyes, that is to preserve God's truth as it is, as we've been commissioned to do. It is a preservative. Notice again Mark 9. In each case, it does speak about salt that loses that savor and how useless it is. Mark 9, verse 49 and 50. For everyone will be seasoned with fire, and every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt. We are living sacrifices. Salt is good, but if the salt loses flavor, how will you season it? Have salt in yourselves and have peace with one another. So here a little different message. Maintain a right relationship with God, with one another. That is done by having a life that has salt in it, Christ living in us, and thus having peace with one another. It emphasizes that Christ's disciples must be faithful in our relationship with God, faithful to our covenant with God and with one another. We've entered into the same covenant as part of God's people. Notice Luke 14, verse 33, 34, and 35. Luke 14, 33, 34, and 35. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. Remember that statement? We probably read it, or it was read when we were counseling for baptism. Whoever does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. It's in the context of counting the cost and all of this earlier in this chapter. And then he says, salt is good, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill, but men throw it out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Here, in this case, emphasizing the importance of maintaining our allegiance and fidelity to God in Christ, that is, putting God first. You go back and look at the whole context, the emphasis is putting God first in our lives. Now think about those three verses we've just read, those three sections. Strictly speaking, salt cannot lose its saltiness. Sodium chloride salt, there are other types of salt, but sodium chloride is a stable compound. But most salt in the ancient world was not that compound of sodium chloride. Most salt in the ancient world derived from salt marshes or things like that. And that's where they got the salt from, rather than by evaporation of salt water. And as a result, it contained many impurities. The actual salt was more soluble. It was easier to dissolve than all the impurities. And so the salt could end up being leached out. And all you were left with was the diluted impurity, the impurities, the salt leached out, and the residue was worthless for salting. All the important stuff had leached out and washed out, and dissolved, but the impurities remained behind. Again, there's a picture in that for us, and it's the kind of salt that Christ is talking about here when he says if it loses flavor, it's worthless. Because all that's left are the impurities, this residue that is worthless. During the feast, it was as though we were a concentrated form of salt, I think. Brethren together for 8 days, hearing God's messages, having God's Spirit, in a sense a high concentration of good salt present at each feast site. Now we're scattered all around the world, in a sense diluted, that is, much less impact in our communities and our neighborhoods in one sense. But Christ reminds us that we're not to be diluted spiritually. We're not to allow the impurities, the salt of Him living in us to be leached out, and that all that's left behind are the impurities of our own human nature, our attitudes, the influence of the world around us. Otherwise, there's little value in that, and it becomes worthless. When Jesus Christ said, "You are the salt of the earth," he was saying that his true disciples, those who remain his true disciples, will not lose their effectiveness, cannot lose their effectiveness, will not lose their saltiness. They will be valuable, those who continually follow him. And the question, can it be made salty again? It's not really meant to have an answer. It's kind of a rhetorical question. The point is that if the disciples of Jesus Christ are to act as preservatives in the world today by conforming to, by living up to the standards of God's kingdom, we heard all about those during the feast, and we're to live up to those standards. And if we're doing that, and if God's disciples are to be a purifying agent, kind of a moral disinfectant, you know, we're not like the world around us, but to be a purifying agent in a world where standards are pretty low. Standards are pretty low. And we're not to allow ourselves to descend to those standards. Standards are low, or they're constantly changing, or they're non-existent. God's people have to maintain high standards. And if they're doing that, we may not be much of a salting agent in the world today, just because of our small numbers. That's up to God. God can use our example as he chooses. But we may not have the same kind of impact, 1,400 people in a community, or 260 or 500, in a smaller community. We may not have as much of an impact in the same way. But if we do all that we can and continue to grow in godly character, with Jesus Christ as our leader and salted, by his character, well, then we're promised, and we saw during the feast, and we heard it over and over again during the feast, we are promised that we will be able to salt the entire world tomorrow, won't we? Jesus Christ and his family will salt the entire world with the salt of God's word, God's truth, and God's spirit. So let's understand and take to heart the statement that Jesus Christ said to his disciples in that day, and that he says to us today. He says, "You are the salt of the earth."